Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We've always been able to make each other laugh. That is one of many wonderful things Patricia Lyon Simon Newman Gelbin said to her only son in the days before she died. Her son, as you may know, is journalist Scott Simon, known to NPR listeners as host of Weekend Edition Saturday. The time he spent beside his mother's final hospital bed was surely heartbreaking, the way it can only be when you watch someone you have loved your whole life struggle just to fill her lungs with oxygen. But Simon's mother was not about to waste those precious breaths complaining. Her final days were spent forming connections with new friends on the hospital staff, making arrangements for old ones to know she'd been thinking of them before she died, and reminiscing, joking, and even singing with her son as they had done together for 60 years. Journalist and author Scott Simon is here for our second day broadcasting from NPR headquarters. His new memoir is called Unforgettable: A Son, a Mother, and the Lessons of a Lifetime. Scott, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Very good to be with you. Thank you.
This book grew out of messages that you posted on Twitter during this time. What made you want to share this experience?
You know, the tweets as opposed to the book, I guess it's all part of one experience at this point. Like a lot of people who are so-called media figures, I keep a pretty active Twitter stream. I was an early adapter. I didn't, when I flew to be with my mother in the intensive care unit, didn't know that she was going to wind up dying there. I still had some hope that she would. She said to me, "Oh, baby, this isn't the end of me. This thing in my lung might be the end of me, but we'll find out and we'll have some time together." I have a lot of different explanations. I didn't know she would wind up dying there. So I just began to talk about what she said. She was just so funny and interesting. I remember one of the first nights that the royal baby had been born to Will and Kate, and there was a picture of the two of them holding their baby. And my mother said, "You know, baby, every baby boy is a king to his mother and father." Oh, my God, I was just struck by that. Or when it seemed obvious which way things were going to go, she said, "I don't know why this is taking so long. I guess I'm just late for everything." I just thought she was so funny and interesting and wise, it was worth sharing.
Your father was a comedian, and people always assumed that if you were funny, it came from him.
Yeah.
You realized that, in fact, your sense of humor is very much informed by your mother.
Sure, because my father, like I think a lot of people who are comedians, professional comedians, my father, first, he didn't give it away. Secondly, you know, he was not a happy, effervescent guy around the apartment or around the hotel room like a lot of comedians. He could see the dark side of life without even trying. That's perhaps arguably why he was a comedian. And he had drinking problems, which I talk about in this book. So he was, I don't want to say he was never funny, but he was not the effervescent one around the apartment. In our family life, it was always my mother who was funny, my mother who was always leaving people laughing.
Looking back now, do you think there were times that she was funny or ebullient for your sake when you were 6 or 7 and your parents were splitting up and you didn't realize that that was a facade?
Oh, undoubtedly. Sure. And it's interesting, that term facade, because I've given a lot of thought. My mother had been a showgirl. My mother was a performer. To say something's a facade doesn't mean they don't absolutely mean it. Because I think in that moment, my mother meant it as a performance to pick up our spirits, sure.
We'll almost all have the experience of losing our parents, and yet when it happens, it feels like the most individual thing in the world, really as individual every time as the people in that relationship.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because in this business, as I don't have to tell you, we probably overuse that term universal. Whenever we want to do
makes
a story.
Makes for a good lead.
Yes, exactly. It's a universal experience. However, dying is certainly a universal experience, although I said that the other day in a church, and I should note, with one exception to people of faith. Although even then, as somebody pointed out, he died and then returned to life. So dying is, in fact, near as we can tell, a universal experience. And losing your parents is, I'm afraid, the way life should be. I think as a parent now, I can appreciate that better. I think my mother understood that. She never referred to what seemed to be her impending death, certainly, as any kind of tragedy. It's the way the world works. We're lucky if we get to see that, aren't we? I was 16 when my father died, and my mother lost a child before me. I can't imagine that particular loss. So we're blessed to be able to have this, and I want people to understand that what prompts this book is not the feeling that, well, I lost my mother and I'll miss her forever and this is a terrible event. I lost my mother and I'll miss her forever, but this is not a terrible event. The hours that we had, the days that we had together in the intensive care unit were a blessing that I think a lot of us would wish for ourselves when the time comes.
So you flew to Chicago to be with her. You didn't know that she was actively dying at that point.
No, but she's 84 and she'd had cancer.
Yeah.
And you don't take anything for granted. She had reached that stage in her life where in fact, she was going to join us in California on vacation. And my wife and I were at the point where we wanted to make an effort to include her in everything that we could because she was in her mid-80s and had cancer. We didn't take anything for granted. But I didn't know that she would die then.
What I love, though, is that you arrive there and find that she's learned the life story of everybody who is just coming in to take her temperature or to change out a water pitcher.
Sweetheart, this is Anne. She went to St. Scholastica. She used to ride the Milwaukee Avenue bus. We've been having the most wonderful time talking about this little Polish bakery that's just on Western Avenue. She knew everybody's life story there. She did that with people all the time, absolutely all the time.
You found her doctors to be, is the word disengaged? Is that the word you would use?
I haven't used that one. I've usually said just not around. I also want this to be plain. I don't even mention the name of the hospital in this book because I'm pretty certain my mother would not want me to use this memoir of those days together and of her life as an opportunity to settle scores with a hospital. I also want it understood, I don't think different medical care could have extended her life even by an hour. I don't know that. She was 84 and had something in her lung. She had survived cancer. Apparently, the radiation treatments she had in the last round probably did deteriorate the strength of her lungs. So I don't want people to think that I'm saying that bad medical care took my mother's life. That's not it at all. But the doctor who signed her into the hospital, her pulmonologist, never saw her again. Her physician of record never saw her while he was in the hospital. The senior physicians, this was July, so the new residents came on. The senior physicians would be in the hallway. Near as I could tell, they were only looking at their screens. And I don't really know of any of them that crossed that threshold to come and look into my mother's face and maybe even hold her hand and actually talk to her. Or at one point, what she needed, what I dare say she probably, what all of us would deserve, would be for a senior physician, preferably someone that she knew, a doctor who she had some history with, to take her hand and say, Pat, I'm sorry, we just have no answers. Alas, that was left to me to tell her.
You know, I was thinking about this because
Can I add one thing,
sure,
Chris?
Sure, of course.
The technicians, the respiratory technicians, the nurses, the RNs, people at that level on the intensive care unit floor were amazing. The book, in fact, is dedicated to them. They were selfless. They were kind. They were loving, even. And this is something they do routinely. I'm sure they have seen scores or hundreds of people to their deaths the way they did my mother. And they don't become hardened by it. In fact, they become kinder, I think, with each and every experience. So I'm in awe of them.
Well, that's where I was going with this, because on the one hand, you could think, well, doctors have to deal with this a lot, and at some point they have to sort of steel themselves. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to have happened. And I think a lot of people have had the experience where a lot of people who are actually involved in that care, where you're touching someone and you're looking someone in the eye.
Oh, I mean, let's be blunt about it. You have to tend to them, don't you, in the most intimate possible way. And they do it. And they do it with love and consideration and dignity and respect. They're extraordinary people who do that for a living. I think the doctors, I don't know, they feel beleaguered. There's a lot of certainly emphasis these days on electronic records, entering a keystroke for every interchange that you have. I don't think they were negligent in that they certainly could, the machines and monitors were hooked up to my mother and they could see what the readings were. It just lacked the human touch. And I think what a lot of people feel when they're in that situation is the end of life calls for the human touch. The end of life in particular really demands and calls for someone to be treated with that elemental respect.
You were sensitive to the fact that as comfortable as she was with you, there were things about her care that embarrassed your mother, just needing her nose wiped when she had oxygen tubes.
I think I write at one point that I wish the people who invented the space shuttle and Roomba could come up with an oxygen tubing that doesn't keep following out of your nose. Or what happens is that the condensation becomes onerous at one point, and so you have to keep removing it and wiping it. And my mother was a woman who, very conscious of her opinion and great dignity, and it's very difficult to wear one of those things for over 5 minutes and maintain your dignity.
One of the things it sounds like that really attracted your mother to your father was the fact that he recognized that she was a funny person.
Yes.
Do you think that they were soulmates?
Yes, I think so, which is not to say that they were necessarily good as a married couple. Mm-hmm. I'm able to say that now, having had the lifetime opportunity to talk to my mother about that in the last days. Look, I'm the proud issue of both of them, but maybe they shouldn't have gotten married. And that has mostly to do with my father's drinking. My father wasn't in a position to be a good husband for anybody. His drinking, even by the time they married, had already begun to take over his life. But at some elemental level, they could make each other laugh like two other people couldn't make each other laugh. And they really never lost that with each other. And that goes a long way. That speaks very deeply to people.
What did you learn reading the correspondence between them long after they divorced?
They got divorced when I was about six. And there were times that I spent with my father. My father was drinking and found it very difficult to hold a job. My mother had been working in clubs and was at that awkward age where it wasn't really easy to go back to that sort of thing anymore. So she would get a hostess job here, a fill-in job there, a temp job there, and I would go back and forth between them. And the letters between them were extraordinary things to read. Well, I didn't, it must be said, to this day I really haven't read anything from my father. But my mother's letters to my father were wonderful because they were still loving. They were not accusatory. She kept referring to him as my beautiful little boy and dearest Ernie or dear loved one. And she would sign off with one variation or another of love. And at one point, apparently, I came across some, you know, all the letters that my mother wrote. I have no idea what my father might have thrown away and what he kept, but this is one that he obviously kept, where they had apparently quarreled the night before on the telephone. My father and I think were in Miami at that point. My father had gotten a job at a club in Miami, and this must have been in the middle of winter, and they'd had some kind of argument on the phone where he must have said, you know, please come back, or I want to come back, or some variation thereof. And my mother, just at that point in her life, knew that that wouldn't work. As she has said to me, she knew that she had to, in a sense, parachute out of the marriage, really for me. She said, you know, actually she said this the night before my wife and I were married. She told my wife, you know, if it had been just left up to me, I would have stayed with Ernest. My father's name was Ernie. But I couldn't do that to our son. We had a son. I couldn't let him ruin his life too. She was willing, in a sense, to throw away her life to be with my father. She wasn't willing to do that for the son they shared. And in any event, as I think, and this was the extraordinary thing, as we got together in those last few days, my mother figured out that my father died because it was the last gift that he could give us. He couldn't stop drinking. And he knew that if he continued living, he would poison his relationship with his son. I would lose respect, maybe even love for him. My mother was convinced he figured out that if he died, it was the best last gift that he could give us.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday, and author of the new memoir, Unforgettable, A Son, A Mother, and the Lessons of a Lifetime. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scott Simon about his new memoir, Unforgettable, A Son, a Mother, and the Lessons of a Lifetime. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Sounds like you and your mom knew a lot of song lyrics in common and would sort of burst into song when
all,
you could.
All the time. We did that all of my life. Yeah. It's, you know, funny. I'm still recovering from that. Of all the interviews I've done for this book, Chris, nobody has played that song until now.
Really?
Yeah.
We got another one coming up later.
All right. Well, I'm a little surprised. My mother wanted to hear some music. We were in the hospital. I knew she loved Nat King Cole. Who was a Chicagoan. She remembered him performing in nightclubs, so that's what I downloaded on my iPad Mini. And for some reason, this song kept coming up over and over again, the original one where Nat does it and then the one where he and his daughter do it together, although not at the same time, but were they 30 years apart by the time they recorded it in the studio or something?
It's funny because I didn't initially really like that re-recording, but sort of in context of this book,
it
seems pretty remarkable.
Yes, it is. It's absolutely remarkable for all. And it's a song that I had heard without ever really hearing the lyrics before. But when you sing it together with someone in the hospital under those circumstances, it takes on extraordinary, unforgettable meaning.
What was your mother's voice like?
She had a much better singing voice than I have. I sort of, all my life, I've done kind of an imitation of my mother, talking like this. She spoke very correctly. My mother, left her own devices, would have had an Irish brogue. That's what she grew up with. But my mother, nowadays, of course, Irish brogues are just adorable, right? You'd be encouraged to keep one. When my mother was growing up, she felt that if you had an Irish brogue, you got your typecast. You were always the scullery maid in life, not just on stage. So my mother made a point of always speaking like this very correctly because she felt that you would just be able to go farther in life. You wouldn't be judged by your brogue that way. And she sang very beautifully.
You brought her into StoryCorps in 2008.
Yes, I did. It was, I think, as I recall, that might have been the opening of StoryCorps in Chicago, and we were asked to be the first interview.
I have to thank you, well, for a couple of things.
What have you learned from me?
Well, two things.
Yes.
More than that, okay, like 1,000 things. But here are two things that I'll list now.
Yes.
And the first is manners.
Really?
I mean, see, I knew you'd say that. What? Learned your manners from me. Don't learn my name that way.
When you would come back from a war zone, you would smell your food before you put it in your mouth. You know, that's manners. Oh boy.
All right. There's some exceptions. All right, but no. So people hear me on the radio, and they think I have very good manners.
Oh, okay. Well, yes.
And that comes from you. That could only come from you because you were so intent on making certain that I said please and thank you and was respectful to people.
Oh, I see. Well, I think any parent, most parents in that way. Your father had lovely manners.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, God, sorry. I haven't heard her voice in a while. Yes, thank you. And she was refusing to be complimented. She was saying that my father was responsible for it, and he did have very good manners. I think that's one of the things they shared. But no, my mother always said that good manners cost nothing and they open doors in life, which I think is true. And I think the best unexpected lecture, and I certainly had it coming, my wife gave me, is that one time we were having dinner, and you know, if our daughters raise a finger and they want something, I become their slave. I vault across the room to get it. And my wife said, "Darling, you have to stop doing that." She said, "You know, the best thing your mother ever gave you." I said, "What's that?" She said, "Manners. I want our daughters to learn manners."
When you think about getting ready for your day, how often do you think about what your mother would think about your outfit?
I think early in the book from the moment I step into my closet, my mother had very clear ideas on how someone should dress. You should dress for the job you want, not the one you have. You should dress with respect. As she said, dressing poorly calls attention to your clothing. Dressing well does not. She said, if you're posing for a picture, try to wear plain colors because you'll find that years later you have less to cringe about. she said, for example, you never know what the day will bring. You know, you could meet the princess of Cambridge, or you could wind up in a hospital emergency room. And if you do, if you're a man, do you want to be the guy who's wearing the blazer? Or the guy who's wearing an Arctic Monkeys suck it and see T-shirt. And, of course, her last bromide is she said, there's usually a reason something's on sale. She would get, I would wear a shirt and she would say, why that shirt? And as if it explained it, I would say to my mother, well, it was on sale. And that's where she'd go, well, honey, there's usually a reason something's on sale. But, you know, funny, I was pleased to have lunch today with some supporters of KERA. And they're a lovely bunch of people. And they were asking me about dressing. And so we did a story on our show that we recorded last Friday in West Baltimore. And I wore a suit and tie, as I do now, because I think those people deserved respect and dignity. I'm in the news business. I'm in a professional. I wanted them to know that I was dressing for them the same way I dressed to interview the President of the United States.
In that clip we heard with your mother, she talked about you coming home from a war zone and sniffing your food.
Yes, that's true.
I'm not going to ask you about sniffing.
In my
your
defense,
food.
I will explain that I had typhoid when I got back from covering a war once in a war zone. And so in any event, yes, I did that for a while.
I'm wondering how she made peace with worrying about you when you went off to places where she wasn't necessarily able to be in regular contact and you could have been killed.
I guess she just understood that that's the son that she had raised. I think it was certainly, I understand that better as a parent now when I, my gosh, I don't know how I come to peace with you know, with our daughters going to the zoo without me. So I think, my God, the lion's going to jump the fence. Something's going to happen. I guess every parent has to do that after a while. I was just going to some places that were a little bit more conspicuously dangerous than others. But I think any parent constructs some kind of catastrophic sequence for themselves in their minds about dangers that might happen to their children.
You have a wonderful description in the book of your maternal grandmother. I love the writing, and I wonder if you would read a little bit of that for us.
Sure. Both my grandmother and grandfather on the Irish side of my family were named Francis. Francis with an E, my grandmother, Francis with an I, the Chicago police sergeant who was my grandfather. My memories of my grandmother, Frances Julia Sullivan, my mother's mother, come wrapped in sugar and smoke. I remember her pink hands presenting me with sugar-sprinkled cookies and cocoa with whipped cream peaks, her pillowy red lips blowing smoky kisses, and her fabulous platinum hair swishing over her bare pink shoulders as she leaned down to kiss the top of my head. "Love you madly," she'd always say. And I remember, or anyhow think I do, her pink toes peeking out below the piano, where we found her Thanksgiving morning. When I was about 4, even as my father put an arm over my eyes, and my mother gasped and sprang forward, and he ran my head into his shoulder as if there were a bomb going off. I guess there was.
She had taken her own life.
Yeah, it was Thanksgiving morning. She had taken her life. She had swallowed pills and a bottle of booze.
How did your mother come to understand her own mother and the extent to which her relationship with her had informed who she became?
Well, my mother confessed to me. Confess isn't probably the word. My mother told me in those last few days that she worried about becoming her mother. As she said, suicide puts a fly in your head. It never quite stops buzzing around. And at one point, my mother had given in to the buzzing and made her own suicide attempt when I was a teenager over a love affair with a married man. She told me my grandmother, Frances, had a number of boyfriends. I had told in the family lore that goes on for years, here she was a beautiful, stylish woman married to a Chicago cop, and the two of them just didn't get along. But an Irish Catholic family, you'd never get a divorce, so she dallied outside the marriage, and he stayed at home and you know, watch White Sox and Cub games on TV. And I think what my to a degree, we blamed my grandfather for somehow not being sparkling enough for my grandmother. And I think my mother at the end understood that that wasn't, I think we always understood that that wasn't fair. She began to think a lot of it was tied up with her mother's drinking. That her father would say, "Francis, you've had enough," whereas her boyfriends or people who became her boyfriends would say, "Fran, have another." So that, almost as much as my father's life, I think traced back to drinking and this the curse of our people, if I may. My father was Jewish, so the curse of several peoples of alcoholism and excessive drinking. And my mother went back methodically, as she told me, and tried to find all of the people she could find records for having been a boyfriend of her mother. And she said, I think of the 8 that she found, 6 of them had made passes at her. And she said they must have assumed that I was like my mother. And so my mother said that she took that as a very bad sign. She was determined not to be like her mother. And ultimately, I think that's why she broke up with the married man, because as she said to me, she couldn't expect to be telling me about the facts of life and then not have me recognize them when they were put in my face when he came over every Thursday night and he would send me off to see a movie. And she said to me, carrying on that relationship with a married man was showing me all the wrong things about love, and she didn't want me to think that that's what love looked like.
It must have been hard, as close to your mother as you were growing up. I mean, everybody's close to their mother, but you two had a special bond because it was just you two in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
To see when she had been hurt and to wonder if she was being treated properly by the people she dated before she ultimately remarried two guys who loved her very much.
Yeah.
Not simultaneously.
No, her life wasn't that interesting. This is plenty interesting. Yes, it was. And to be fair to all of the men that my mother dated, I was a jerk. I was a young, can I say schmuck on KERA?
I think you can.
Yeah, I was a young schmuck. I was on my father's side. And these people, the smartest of them would say something like, you know, Scotty, I don't want to be your dad, but maybe we can be pals. And of course, I should have respected that as the nice gesture than it was. Instead, I just found that inauthentic and cluckish and hard to accept. I wasn't very nice to them. And they were, I was about to say, with the exception of the married man, they were all nice men. In his own way, the married man was certainly he was very nice to me. So I really have no complaints on that score. My mother certainly went into that with her eyes open. But yes, I worried about that sort of thing all the time.
When you think about being a kid, it sounds like your mom often didn't have a lot of money, but it sounds like she went out of her way to expose you to the finer things in life.
Yes.
Talk about some of the ways that she did that.
She'd bring me to the Chicago Art Institute quite a lot, and we would stand by some of the greatest paintings in the world and inhabit them for a while. As my mother used to say, when she began to walk into the Art Institute, she'd been working various jobs on Rush Street, and it was one of the first places with, I'll use our word again, Chris, universal air conditioning. For the paintings, not the people, but she would walk in there on a scorching summer day, and she would say, and then, you know, you see a rainy street in Paris, or you see a South Sea Island. Suddenly the city disappears. You can inhabit that. I believe I tell this story in the book. It was when she brought our oldest daughter, Elise, into the ladies' room of the Drake Hotel in Chicago because they had such a great ladies' room. The Drake is where a lot of people on the Irish side of my family worked. Shaking sheets at the Drake used to be a phrase. My grandmother was the maitre d'es at the Cape Cod Room, restaurant that's still there at the Drake Hotel. And my mother would learn between jobs on Rush Street, she could nip into the ladies' room at the Drake and change into whatever her next, the hostess costume she'd have to wear or something like that. And she made a point the night before her first cancer surgery of bringing our daughter, oldest daughter then, Elise, into the ladies' room at the Drake Hotel. And my wife and my mother and Elise walked out of the ladies' room, and my wife had tears in her eyes. I wondered what the hell was going on in that ladies' room. And my wife told me that my mother had said to our daughter, I'm going to have, problems with this now, that my mother had said to our daughter, honey, remember, never be afraid to go into a classy place. Remember, you deserve it. And I said to my mother, my God, I found that stupefying. Was this your way of saying to our little girl who was born in China, look, honey, I was an Irish immigrant and they didn't exactly welcome us in this city. But remember, you belong to a classy place. And my mother said, you're overthinking that. And she said, I didn't know what would happen in the surgery the next day. I didn't know if I'd ever get her a chance to bring her to the Art Institute so I could at least show her a really classy bathroom.
Was there anything you two couldn't talk about?
By the end, I don't think so. We didn't talk a lot about her suicide attempt after that happened when I was a teenager. She kind of dismissed it the next few years, really, by saying, well, that was crazy. What was I thinking of? We certainly did talk about it in our last days together in her room. I don't know if there was anything left unsaid. It doesn't occur to me. I'm sure something must have been there, but I think we could talk about everything pretty much. My mother had said to my wife, I think in the early years of my marriage to Caroline, that she thought we had raised each other, that my mother and I had raised each other. And I don't feel that way. My mother certainly raised me, but I probably got insights. I got to see her as a person, not just a mother. I got to see how she reacted to various challenges in life, and I'm very glad I did. I think I appreciate her more as a mother because I got to see a lot of what she had to contend with in life.
We're speaking this hour with journalist and author Scott Simon. His new memoir is called Unforgettable, A Son, a Mother, and the Lessons of a Lifetime. We'll resume the conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scott Simon, whose new memoir is Unforgettable, Son, a Mother, and the Lessons of a Lifetime. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. That was another one that you played from your iPad?
Yes, and my mother and I sang it together as we had all of my life. You know, it's because I'm sitting here listening to it and tearing up all over again, but for several reasons, my father and my mother used to sing that because my father had enlisted in the British Army in World War II, before it was World War II in the United States, mm-hmm. in 1939. And, of course, that was Dame, I believe you were playing, in fact, Dame Vera Lynn's,
yes.
Version, if
mm-hmm.
I'm not mistaken. And that song was very important to him, and the two of them used to sing it together. And, of course, my mother and I sang it together in the hospital. We sang it together because it was a song that was important to our family, and we enjoyed singing together. I don't mind saying I think there was also a hope expressed there that those were the last hours and days of her life, but it wouldn't necessarily be our last times together. I don't mean to get all ethereal on you, but I believe in heaven. I don't have a rational argument to prove it. I can't prove it. I had a long conversation about this with Christopher Hitchens once, whom I loved. And this was before he came down with what turned out to be his terminal illness. But I'd say, you know, Christopher, who, you know, I think in the end both of us are going to be wrong about this. I don't care if I'm right. I just want to have a belief that helps me get through, you know, the long night sometimes. And that's what I believe. I like to think that we're going to see each other.
Are you, she believed that too.
Yes, she
without,
did.
She didn't question it.
She didn't question it. And part of it might have been, she had a pretty religious background as a Catholic. But I think most of it was personal. I think it was just very hard, as it is still hard for me, to think that we go on to utter nothingness in life. And at one point she looked up at me and she said, will this go on forever? And I think she meant the pain and just the dread of expectation. And I said, no, it won't go on forever. And she said, but you and me will go on forever. I believe that too.
I'm going to change the mood here.
Sorry.
No. What I love about meeting your mother through this book, I never met her, and now I feel like I know her, and I wish that I could, you know, spend hours and weeks with her. Your wife came to be with you when it became apparent that this was the end. Your little girls were too small to go into
They don't let them into the intensive care unit at this hospital. Yeah.
Right. So they were staying with a friend. You went down to go have a cup of coffee together and just talk, and you left your mother for a moment, and she advised you to use the time that you had.
These were just about her last words, interestingly enough, except for two others she uttered a few hours later. I was bringing my wife downstairs to the Starbucks, inevitably, in the hospital, and I said to my mother, I'm going to bring Caroline, my wife, downstairs and, you know, get a cup of coffee and I'll come back. And she said, you don't have the kids. Stop for a quickie. latte. And a quick one, however.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones here at 1-800-933-5372. We have Maggie on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. Two of my favorite radio personalities together again.
Oh,
I just want to remind the Washington, D.C. folks, send Chris back home when she's done.
I'm coming home. Don't worry.
I have a compliment and an observation for Scott. I don't think it's Irish. I have the same problem, but you don't have the same robust filter for emotions. You cry on the air more. You've demonstrated it here.
Well, I handle myself most of the time, but yeah, all right.
Well, I'm usually crying when you are. I feel it coming on. And I like that aspect of your on-air performance.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Was it something that you had to just be okay with because that's part of who you are and you realize that it would almost be more artificial to try to conceal that?
Yeah. I mean, I did work a little at trying to, I work now at trying to conceal it, Grace. It just doesn't end very successful, unfortunately. And you do, you know, when you're talking about difficult material, even when it's personal, there's a kind of professional switch that we can throw that just gets us through there. I mean, I remember when we were doing so much live broadcasting the days following 9/11, often I was overcome with something and had to stop and catch my voice. Or when we were, I think it was the day that the space shuttle exploded in the skies over Texas, as a matter of fact. And I remember having to catch myself that way there. But I sometimes when we talk about certain events, I think it's artificial not to let, I don't say become so weepy you can't communicate, not as maybe weepy as I can be now here in the studio with you talking about my mother, but I think it's you're not really experiencing the import of the event if you aren't at some level experiencing and giving vent to some of the emotion in it.
When your mother died, you had your own grief, but you also had to watch your daughters experiencing this.
Oh, that conversation where even though, you know, it was the old story our oldest daughter was very stiff upper lip.
Yeah, well, yeah, you said that might happen.
And, of course, our youngest daughter just burst into tears and was inconsolable. But she stopped crying after a couple of hours and went to sleep. And, of course, who really was inconsolable but her oldest daughter, who
was older and still has a hard time with the fact that she wasn't able to get into the hospital. But, yeah, that's to experience death at their age, through them at that. I'd hope they could have been a little older before I had to do that. Life doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah, it is hard that there are some things you cannot protect your children from.
Yeah. You know, I slept on this orange camp mat on the floor of the ICU next to my mother, the thing I'd gotten at a sporting goods store on North Michigan Avenue. And, of course, we took it home from the hospital. And that first night and for a couple of weeks thereafter, our oldest daughter would sleep on that camp mat next to our bed. And my wife at one point said, "Darling, don't worry. At some point, she's going to go back to her room." And I said, "Are you kidding? She can stay with us until she's 30, as far as I'm concerned." Not very healthy for either of us.
One of the things that your mother had you do while she was in the hospital was, I don't know, take $20 bills out of her purse and take these.
I wound up taking
notes.
Them out of my pocket.
Okay,
yes, but
okay.
Yeah, she wanted me to take some money from her purse because she had not been able to pay a seamstress. As it turned out, my mother had been losing an alarming amount of weight, so she paid a seamstress to take in her blue jeans that she was going to wear on vacation with us in California, and she hadn't been able to keep the appointment for her manicure and that she was going to get before going away. And she said that, you know, these are two women who work for a living and work for tips, and she was insistent that I take them the money. And they both didn't want to take the money. The seamstress says, "No, no, no," when she comes out and has, you know, and said, "No, no, no." I insisted and pressed it on her. The manicurist was particularly insistent, and thankfully a little bit of my mother came into me then, because I said, "My mother said that you have a six-year-old boy." And she said, "Yes, I show your mother pictures of my little boy." This is Maria. "She shows me pictures of your daughters. They're very cute." And I said, "You know, my mother once had a little boy, and she worked a lot of different jobs to give him the best life that she could. And here I am. And we both want you to have this." My mother knew what it was like to work for tips. It was very important to her. She knew that these women relied on her tips. It was very important to her in all ways that I bring them that money. And I was so glad that I was able to pipe enough of my mother into my own human character at that point to be able to come up with the right sequence of words to say to Maria to get her to accept the money, because she didn't want to. She didn't want to. But once I said, "Oh, my mother had a son, and here I am," I think it let her take the money, and I'm so glad.
Nobody would say, "I wish that this child grow up with a mother who's often struggling for money," and yet I have to imagine that experience, given the success you have now and that things are, you know, financially comfortable, you feel that in a way that you wouldn't have if you had grown up with everything in
the
world.
Oh, sure. I mean, I don't know any other way, but I think that's absolutely true. I hope I never lose sight of the fact. And look, I mean, I think by any generous definition, what you and I do for a living is not exactly coal mining. So I know there were. I just did a story for CBS Sunday Morning in Texas, as a matter of fact, where it was out on a cattle drive. That's working. What they do is really working hard. I mean, people like you and me, I work hard as we understand it, but not quite in the same way. But I hope I understand what goes into a dollar. And my wife and I have talked about the fact that we hope our daughters understand that. I don't know how to pass that along, because, of course, I don't want to deprive them of anything. I'm the original spoiler in chief where our daughters are concerned. But I like to think at some point that knowledge and that wisdom is going to catch up with them. It's one of the reasons, in a funny way, I wrote the book, because they're going to have to grow up without knowing my mother, except insofar as they can open the book and read about her and remember her.
I hope that you won't find this question rude. Mm. Your mother became your mother when she was quite young.
Yes.
You became a father when you were older. There was a
yes,
know.
That's true. Yeah.
You got a lot of years with your mother.
Yes, and I treasure that. I hope nothing I say makes it sound as if I felt that somehow, you know, we were cheated out of the last few years together or anything like that. No, you know, and people have asked me what I consider to be a rude question when they'll say something like, well, why did you wait so long to have children? Is this going to be fair to your children? Because presumably I'll depart at an earlier time unless they've, you know, come up with all kinds of medical advances. And that's when I have to cast back to the fact that I was 16 when my father died, so that's a little bit young. I was 4 when my grandmother died. So, I think I was 17 when my grandfather died on the Irish side of the family. That's just how life worked out. I know I'm a better father now than I would have been if I'd become a father at the same age my mother became a mother. Where was she? 21, 23, I think. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I became a father. I didn't become a father until I met my wife. I think I married the most wonderful woman in the world. All the women in this studio and around us in the control room and listening in Central Texas, notwithstanding, I married the most wonderful woman in the world. And I the thing is, you mentioned professional success. Nothing pleased my mother more than my family, my wife and marriage. I talk about our friend Mark Shulman, who runs Eli's Cheesecake of Chicago, who brought cheesecake treats over to the hospital. And Mark and I had grown up together in many ways, and my mother talked about, she said, you worry about children, boys especially, but you and Mark turned out just fine. And I said, but you should see what he's done with his father's cheesecake recipe, Mother. They're selling that cheesecake in New York now. And she said, I didn't mean any of that. I meant the way you both made such beautiful families. That's what was important to her.
I'll tell you my impression when I closed your book, and I loved it. I hope that my children feel as loved by me as you felt by your mother.
They will. They will. I'm sure of it. They may not always voice it.
Or believe it.
Or believe it. I think they go through that period too, but they will. I have no doubt about that. And I think mothers and children know that, even if they go through rocky periods, even if they sometimes give voice to other things. I think there's that cord that brings us together, that it's the lifeblood. That's what they mean. It's the blood and love and sweat and tears that passes through each of us to the other that always keeps us together.
Scott Simon, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
The new memoir by Scott Simon is called Unforgettable. A mother, a son, a mother, and the lessons of a lifetime. We want to thank our team in Washington, D.C., Stephen Becker, Jeff Whittington, and Rick Holter, also engineer Elizabeth Ockley. Back in Dallas, we have Shelley Canavy, Lindsay Connect, and Kristen Taylor. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening from Washington this week. Have a great day.